She had dropped out of school and had no sort of higher education. The first few months she had worked full-time. Well, almost full-time. She turned up at the office now and then. She made coffee, went to the post office and took care of the copying. But conventional office hours or work routines were anathema to her. On the other hand, she had a talent for irritating the other employees. She became known as the girl with two brain cells, one for breathing and one for standing up. She never talked about herself. Colleagues who tried to talk to her seldom got a response and soon gave up. Her attitude encouraged neither trust nor friendship, and she quickly became an outsider, wandering the corridors of Milton like a stray cat. She was generally considered a hopeless case. After a month of nothing but trouble, Armansky sent for her, fully intending to let her go. She listened to his catalogue of her offences without objection and without even raising an eyebrow. She did not have the right attitude, he concluded. I was about to tell her that it would probably be a good idea if she looked for employment with another firm that could make better use of her skills. Only then did she interrupt him.
You know, if you just want an office serf, you can get one from the temp agency. I can handle anything and anyone you want, and if you don't have any better use for me than sorting post, then you're an idiot.
Armansky sat there, stunned and angry, and she went on, unperturbed.
You have a man here who spent 3 weeks writing a completely useless report about that yuppie they're thinking of recruiting for that dot-com company. I copied the piece of crap for him last night, and I see it's lying on your desk right now.
Armansky's eyes went to the report, and for a change, he raised his voice.
You're not supposed to read confidential reports.
Apparently not. But the security routines in your firm have a number of shortcomings. According to your directive, he's supposed to copy such things himself. But he chucked the report at me before he left for the bar yesterday. And by the way, I found his previous report in the canteen.
You did what?
Calm down, I put it in his inbox.
Did he give you the combination of his document safe?
Armansky was aghast.
Not exactly. He wrote it on a piece of paper he kept underneath his blotter along with the password to his computer. But the point is that your joke of a private detective has done a worthless personal investigation. He missed the fact that the guy has old gambling debts and snorts cocaine like a vacuum cleaner, or that his girlfriend had to seek help from the Women's Crisis Center after he beat the shit out of her.
Armansky sat for a couple of minutes, turning the pages of the report. It was completely set out, written in clear language, and filled with source references as well as statements from the subject's friends and acquaintances. Finally, he raised his eyes and said two words.
Prove it.
How much time have I got?
3 days. If you can't prove your allegations by Friday afternoon, you're fired.
3 days later, she delivered a report which, with equally exhaustive source references, transformed the outwardly pleasant young yuppie into an unreliable bastard. Armansky read her report over the weekend, several times, and spent part of Monday doing a half-hearted double-check of some of her assertions. Even before he began, he knew that her information would prove to be accurate. Armansky was bewildered and also angry with himself for having so obviously misjudged her. He had taken her for stupid, maybe even retarded. He had not expected that a girl who had cut so many classes in school that she did not graduate could write a report so grammatically correct. It also contained detailed observations and information, and he quite simply could not comprehend how she could have acquired such facts. He could not imagine that anyone else at Milton Security would have lifted excerpts from the confidential journal of a doctor at a women's crisis center. When he asked her how she had managed that, she told him that she had no intention of burning her sources. It became clear that Salander was not going to discuss her work methods either with him or with anyone else. This disturbed him, but not enough for him to resist the temptation to test her. He thought about the matter for several days. He recalled Holger Palmgren's saying when he had sent her to him, "Everyone deserves a chance." He thought about his own Muslim upbringing, which had taught him that it was his duty to God to help the outcasts. Of course, he did not believe in God and had not been in a mosque since he was a teenager, but he recognized Lisbeth Salander as a person in need of resolute help. He had not done much along these lines over the past few decades. Instead of giving Salander the boot, he summoned her for a meeting in which he tried to work out what made the difficult girl tick. His impression was confirmed that she suffered from some serious emotional problem, but he also discovered that behind her sullen facade there was an unusual intelligence. He found her prickly and irksome, but much to his surprise, he began to like her. Over the following months, Armansky took Salander under his wing. In truth, he took her on as a small social project. He gave her straightforward research tasks and tried to give her guidelines on how to proceed. She would listen patiently, and then set off to carry out the assignment just as she saw fit. He asked Milton's technical director to give her a basic course in IT science. They sat together all afternoon until he reported back that she seemed to have a better understanding of computers than most of the staff. But despite development discussions, offers of in-house training, and other forms of enticement, it was evident that Salander had no intention of adapting to Milton's office routines. This put Armansky in a difficult spot. He would not have put up with any other employee coming and going at will, and under normal circumstances he would have demanded that she change or go. But he had a hunch that if he gave Salander an ultimatum, or threatened to fire her, she would simply shrug her shoulders and be gone. A more serious problem was that he could not be sure of his own feelings for the young woman. She was like a nagging itch, repellent and at the same time tempting. It was not a sexual attraction, at least he did not think so. The women he was usually attracted to were blonde and curvaceous, with full lips that aroused his fantasies. And besides, he had been married for 20 years to a Finnish woman named Ritva, who still more than satisfied these requirements. He had never been unfaithful. Well, something may have happened, just once, and his wife might have misunderstood if she had known about it, but the marriage was happy, and he had 2 daughters of Salander's age. In any case, he was not interested in flat-chested girls who might be mistaken for skinny boys at a distance. That was not his style. Even so, he had caught himself having inappropriate daydreams about Lisbeth Salander, and he recognized that he was not completely unaffected by her. But the attraction, Armansky thought, was that Salander was a foreign creature to him. He might just as well have fallen in love with a painting of a nymph on a Greek amphora. Salander represented a life that was not real for him, that fascinated him, though he could not share it, and in any case she forbade him from sharing it. On one occasion Armansky was sitting at a café on Stortorget in Gamla Stan when Salander came sauntering up and sat at a table a short distance away. She was with 3 girls and a boy, all dressed in much the same way. Armansky had watched her with interest. She seemed to be just as reserved as she was at work, but she had actually almost smiled at a story told by one of her companions, a girl with purple hair. Armansky wondered how she would react if one day he came to work with green hair, worn-out jeans, and a leather jacket covered with graffiti and rivets. She probably would just smirk at him. She had been sitting with her back to him and did not turn around once, obviously unaware that he was there. He felt strangely disturbed by her presence. When at last he got up to slink away unnoticed, she suddenly turned and stared straight at him, as though she had been aware all the time that he was sitting there and had him on her radar. Her gaze had come so surprisingly that it felt like an attack, and he pretended not to see her and hurriedly left the café. She had not said hello, even, but she followed him with her eyes, he was sure of it, and not until he turned the corner did they stop burning into his neck. She rarely laughed, but over time Armansky thought he noticed a softening of her attitude. She had a dry sense of humour, to put it mildly, which could prompt a crooked, ironic smile. Armansky felt so provoked by her lack of emotional response that sometimes he wanted to grab hold of her and shake her, to force his way into her shell and win her friendship, or at least her respect. Only once, after she had been working for him for 9 months, had he tried to discuss these feelings with her. It was at Milton Security's Christmas party one evening in December, and for once he was not sober. Nothing inappropriate had happened. He had just tried to tell her that he actually liked her. Most of all, he wanted to explain that he felt protective towards her, and if she ever needed help with anything, she should not hesitate to come to him. He had even tried to give her a hug, all in friendliness, of course. She had wriggled out of his clumsy embrace and left the party. After that, she had not appeared at the office or answered her mobile.
Her absence had felt like torture, almost a form of personal punishment. He had nobody to discuss his feelings with, and for the first time he realized, with appalling clarity, what a destructive hold she had over him. 3 weeks later, when Armansky was working late one evening going over the year-end bookkeeping, Salander reappeared. She came into his office as silently as a ghost, and he became aware that she was standing in the shadows inside the doorway watching him. He had no idea how long she had been there. "Would you like some coffee?" she asked. She handed him a cup from the espresso machine in the canteen. Mutely he accepted it, feeling both relief and terror when she shoved the door closed with her foot. She sat down opposite his desk and looked him straight in the eye. Then she asked the question in a way that could neither be laughed off nor avoided. "Dragan, are you attracted to me?" Armansky sat as if paralyzed, while desperately wondering how to answer. His first impulse was to pretend to be insulted. Then he saw her expression, and it came to him that this was the first time she had ever uttered any such personal question. It was seriously meant, and if he tried to laugh it off, she would take it as an affront. She wanted to talk to him, and he wondered how long it had taken her to get up the courage to ask that question. He slowly put down his pen and leaned back in his chair. Finally, he relaxed.
"What makes you think that?" he said.
"The way you look at me, and the way you don't look at me, and the times you were about to reach out your hand and touch me but stopped yourself." He smiled at her.
"I reckon you'd bite off my hand if I laid a finger on you."
She did not smile. She was waiting.
"Lisbeth, I'm your boss, and even if I were attracted to you, I'd never act on it."
She was still waiting.
"Between us? Yes. There have been times when I have felt attracted to you. I can't explain it, but that's the way it is. For some reason I don't really understand, I like you a lot. But it's not a physical thing."
"That's good, because it'll never happen." Armansky laughed. The first time she had said something personal, and it was the most disheartening news a man could imagine receiving. He struggled to find the right words.
"Lisbeth, I understand that you're not interested in an old man of 50+.
"I'm not interested in an old man of 50+. Who's my boss?" She held up a hand. "Wait, let me speak. You're sometimes stupid and maddeningly bureaucratic, but you're actually an attractive man, and I can also feel. But you're my boss, and I've met your wife, and I want to keep my job with you, and the most idiotic thing I could do is get involved with you."
Armansky said nothing, hardly daring to breathe.
"I'm aware of what you've done for me, and I'm not ungrateful. I appreciate that you actually showed yourself to be greater than your prejudices and have given me a chance here, but I don't want you for my lover, and you're not my father."
After a while, Armansky sighed helplessly. "What exactly do you want from me?"
"I want to continue working for you, if that's okay with you."
He nodded and then answered her as honestly as he could. "I really do want you to work for me, but I also want you to feel some sort of friendship and trust in me."
She nodded.
"You're not a person who encourages friendship," he said.
She seemed to withdraw, but he went on.
"I understand that you don't want anyone interfering in your life, and I'll try not to do that. But is it all right if I continue to like you?"
Salander thought about it for a long time. Then she replied by getting up, walking around the desk and giving him a hug. He was totally shocked. Only when she released him did he take her hand.
"We can be friends?"
She nodded once. That was the only time she ever showed him any tenderness, and the only time she ever touched him. It was a moment that Armansky fondly remembered. After 4 years, she had still vouchsafed hardly a detail about her private life or her background to Armansky. Once he applied his own knowledge of the Pindar's art on her. He also had a long talk with Holger Palmgren, who did not seem surprised to see him, and what he finally found out did not increase his trust in her. He never mentioned a word about this to her, or let her know that he had been snooping into her life. Instead, he hid his uneasiness and increased his watchfulness.
Before that strange evening was over, Armansky and Salander had come to an agreement. In future, she would do research projects for him on a freelance basis. She would receive a small monthly income, whether she did any assignments or not. The real money would be made when she was paid per assignment. She could work the way she wanted to. In return, she pledged never to do anything that might embarrass him or risk subjecting Milton Security to scandal. For Armansky, this was a solution that was advantageous to him, the company, and Salander herself. He cut the troublesome PI department down to a single full-time employee, an older colleague who handled routine jobs perfectly well and ran credit checks. All complicated or tricky assignments he turned over to Salander and a few other freelancers who, in the last resort, were independent contractors for whom Milton Security had actually no responsibility. Since he regularly engaged her services, she earned a good salary. It could have been much higher, but Salander worked only when she felt like it. Armansky accepted her as she was, but she was not allowed to meet the clients. Today's assignment was an exception. Salander was dressed for the day in a black T-shirt with a picture on it of E.T. with fangs and the words, "I am also an alien." She had on a black shirt that was frayed at the hem, a worn-out black mid-length leather jacket, rivet belt, heavy Doc Marten boots, and horizontally striped green and red knee socks. She had put on makeup in a color scheme that indicated she might be color blind. In other words, she was exceptionally decked out. Armansky sighed and shifted his gaze to the conservatively dressed guest with the thick glasses. Dirk Froder, a lawyer, had insisted on meeting and being able to ask questions of the employee who prepared the report. Armansky had done all he civilly could to prevent the meeting taking place, saying that Salander had a cold, was away, or was swamped with other work. The lawyer replied calmly that it made no difference. The matter was not urgent, and he could easily wait a couple of days. At last, there was no way to avoid bringing them together. Now Froda, who seemed to be in his late 60s, was looking at Lisbeth Salander with evident fascination. Salander glowered back with an expression that did not indicate any warm feelings. Armansky sighed and looked once more at the folder she had placed on his desk, labeled Carl Mikael Blomqvist. The name was followed by a social security number, neatly printed on the cover. He said the name out loud. Herr Froder snapped out of his bewitched state and turned to Armansky. "So, what can you tell me about Mikael Blomqvist?" he said.
"This is Ms. Salander who prepared the report."
Armansky hesitated a second and then went on with a smile that was intended to engender confidence, but which seemed helplessly apologetic.
"Don't be fooled by her youth. She is our absolute best researcher."
"I'm persuaded of that," Froder said, in a dry tone that hinted at the opposite. "Tell me what she found out." It was clear that Froder had no idea how to act towards Salander. He resorted to directing the questions to Armansky as if she had not been in the room. Salander blew a big bubble with her gum. Before Armansky could answer, she said, "Could you ask the client whether he would prefer the long or the short version?" There was a brief, embarrassed silence before Froder finally turned to Salander and tried to repair the damage by assuming a friendly, avuncular tone. "I would be grateful if the young lady would give me a verbal summary of the results." For a moment her expression was so surprisingly hostile that it sent a cold shiver down Froder's spine. Then just as quickly her expression softened, and Froder wondered whether he had imagined that look. When she began to speak, she sounded like a civil servant. "Allow me to say first that this was not a very complicated assignment, apart from the fact that the description of the task itself was somewhat vague. You wanted to know everything that could be dug up about him, but gave no indication of whether there was anything in particular you were looking for. For this reason, it's something of a potpourri of his life. The report is 193 pages long, but 120 pages are copies of articles he wrote or press clippings. Blomqvist is a public person with few secrets and not very much to hide."
"But he does have some secrets," Froder said.
"Everyone has secrets," she replied neutrally. "It's just a matter of finding out what they are."
"Let's hear."
Mikael Blomqvist was born on January 18, 1960, which makes him 42 years old. He was born in Borlänge, but has never lived there. His parents, Kurt and Anita Blomqvist, were around 35 when the child was born. Both have since died. His father was a machinery installer and moved around a good deal. His mother, as far as I could see, was never anything but a housewife. The family moved house to Stockholm when Michael started school. He has a sister 3 years younger named Annika, who is a lawyer. He also has some cousins, both male and female. Were you planning to serve coffee?
This last was directed at Armansky, who hastily pumped 3 cups of coffee from the thermos he had ordered for the meeting. He motioned for Salander to go on.
So in 1966 the family lived in Lilla Essingen. Blomqvist went to school first in Blomma, and then to prep school on Kungsholmen. He had decent graduating marks. There are copies in the folder. During his prep school days he studied music and played bass in a rock band named Bootstrap, which actually put out a single that was played on the radio in the summer of 1979. After prep school he worked as a ticket collector in the Tunnelbana, saved some money and travelled abroad. He was away for a year, mostly bumming around Asia, India, Thailand, and a swing down to Australia. He began studying to be a journalist in Stockholm when he was 21, but interrupted his studies after the first year to do his military service as a rifleman in Kiruna in Lapland. It was some sort of macho unit, and he left with good marks. After military service, he completed his journalism degree and has worked in the field ever since. How detailed do you want me to be?
Just tell me what you think is important.
He comes off a little like Practical Pig in The Three Little Pigs. So far he has been an excellent journalist. In the 80s he had a lot of temporary jobs, first in the provincial press and then in Stockholm. There's a list. His breakthrough came with a story about the Bear Gang, the bank robbers he identified.
Kalle Blomqvist.
He hates the nickname, which is understandable. Somebody get a fat lip if they ever called me Pippi Longstocking on a newspaper placard.
She cast a dark look at Armansky, who swallowed hard. On more than one occasion he had thought of Salander as precisely Pippi Longstocking. He waved for her to get on with it.
One source declares that up to then he wanted to be a crime reporter, and he interned as one at an evening paper, but he has become known for his work as a political and financial reporter. He has primarily been a freelancer with one full-time position at an evening paper in the late 80s. He left in 1990 when he helped start the monthly magazine Millennium. The magazine began as a real outsider without any big publishing company to hold its hand. Its circulation has grown and today is 21,000 copies monthly. The editorial office is on Gurtgarten, only a few blocks from here.
A left-wing magazine.
That depends on how you define the concept left-wing. Millennium is generally viewed as critical of society, but I'm guessing the anarchists think it's a wimpy bourgeois crap magazine along the lines of Arena or Ord Front, while the Moderate Students' Association probably thinks that the editors are all Bolsheviks. There is nothing to indicate that Blomqvist has ever been active, politically, even during the left-wing wave when he was going to prep school. While he was plugging away at the School of Journalism, he was living with a girl who at the time was active in the syndicalists, and today sits in Parliament as a representative of the Left Party. He seems to have been given the left-wing stamp primarily because, as a financial journalist, he specialises in investigative reporting about corruption and shady transactions in the corporate world. He has done some devastating individual portraits of captains of industry and politicians, which were most likely well-deserved, and caused a number of resignations and legal repercussions. The most well-known was the Arboga affair, which resulted in the forced resignation of a conservative politician and the sentencing of a former councillor to a year in prison for embezzlement. Calling attention to crimes can hardly be considered an indication that someone is left-wing.
I understand what you mean. What else?
He has written 2 books, one about the Arboga affair and one about financial journalism, entitled The Knights Templar, which came out 3 years ago. I haven't read the book, but judging from the reviews it seems to have been controversial. It prompted a good deal of debate in the media.
Money, Froda said.
He's not rich, but he's not starving. Income tax returns are attached to the report. He has about 250,000 Swedish krona in the bank, in both a retirement fund and a savings account. He has an account of around 100,000 krona that he uses as cash for working expenses, travel and such. He owns a co-op apartment that's paid off, 700 square feet on Bellmansgarten, and he has no loans or debts. He has one other asset, some property in Sandhamn, out in the archipelago. It's a cottage of 260 square feet, furnished as a summer cabin and by the water, right in the most attractive part of the village. Apparently an uncle of his bought it in the '40s, when such things were still possible for normal mortals, and the cabin ended up in Blomqvist's hands. They divided things up so that his sister got the parents' apartment in Lille Essingen, and Blomqvist got the cabin. I have no idea what it might be worth today, certainly a few million. But on the other hand, he doesn't seem to want to sell, and he goes out to Sandhamn fairly often.
Income?
He's part owner of Millennium, but he only takes out about 12,000 in salary each month. The rest he earns from his freelance jobs. The total varies. He had a big year 3 years ago when he took in around 450,000. Last year he only made 120,000 from freelance jobs.
He has to pay 150,000 in taxes in addition to lawyers' fees, etc., Froda said. Let's assume that the total is rather high. He'll also be losing money while serving his jail term.
Which means that he's going to be cleaned out, Salander said.
Is he honest?
That's his trust capital, so to speak. His image is to appear as the guardian of robust morality, as opposed to the business world, and he is invited pretty regularly to pontificate on television.
There probably isn't much left of that capital after his conviction today, Frodo said.
I don't want to claim that I know exactly what demands are made on a journalist, but after this setback it will probably be a long time before Master Detective Blomqvist wins the grand prize for journalism. He's really made a fool of himself this time, Salander said. If I may make a personal comment...
Armansky opened his eyes wide. In the years Salander had worked for him, she had never made a single personal comment in an investigation of an individual. Bone-dry facts were all that mattered to her.
It wasn't part of my assignment to look at the question of fact in the Venestrom affair, but I did follow the trial and have to admit that I was actually flabbergasted. The thing felt wrong, and it's totally out of character for Mikhail Blomqvist to publish something that seems to be so off the wall.
Salander scratched her neck. Froda looked patient. Armansky wondered whether he might be mistaken, or whether Salander really was unsure how to continue. The Salander he knew was never unsure or hesitant. Finally, she seemed to make up her mind.
Quite off the record, so to speak. I haven't studied the Venestrom affair properly, but I really think that Mikhail Blomqvist was set up. I think there's something totally different in this story than what the court's verdict is indicating.
The lawyer scrutinized Salander with searching eyes, and Armansky noticed that for the first time since she began her report, the client was showing more than a polite interest. He made a mental note that the Venestrom affair held a certain interest for Froda. Correction. Armansky thought at once, Froda was not interested in the Venestrom affair. It was when Salander hinted that Blomqvist was set up that Froda reacted.
How do you mean, exactly? Froda said.
It's speculation on my part, but I'm convinced that someone tricked him.
And what makes you think so?
Everything in Blomqvist's background shows that he's a very careful reporter. Every controversial revelation he published before was always well documented. I went to court one day and listened. He seemed to have given up without a fight. That doesn't accord with his character at all. If we had to believe the court, he made up a story about Venestrom without a shred of evidence and published it like some sort of journalistic suicide bomber. That's simply not Blomqvist's style.
So what do you think happened?
I can only guess. Blomqvist believed in his story, but something happened along the way, and the information turned out to be false. This in turn means that the source was someone he trusted, or that someone deliberately fed him false information, which sounds improbably complicated. The alternative is that he was subjected to such a serious threat that he threw in the towel and would rather be seen as an incompetent idiot than fight back. But I'm just speculating, as I said.
When Salander made an attempt to continue her account, Froda held up his hand. He sat for a moment, drumming his fingers on the armrest of his chair, before he hesitantly turned to her again.
If we should decide to engage you to unravel the truth in the Venestrom affair, how much chance is there that you'd find out anything?
I can't answer that. There may not be anything to find.
But would you be willing to make an attempt?
She shrugged.
It's not my place to decide. I work for Herr Armansky, and he decides what jobs he wants to assign to me. And then it depends what sort of information you're looking for.
Let me put it this way.
And I take it that we're speaking in confidence?
Armansky nodded.
I don't know anything about this particular matter, but I do know beyond any doubt that in other situations Wennerström has acted dishonestly. The Wennerström case has seriously affected Mikhail Blomkvist's life, and I have an interest in discerning whether there's anything in your speculations.
The conversation had taken an unexpected turn, and Armansky was instantly on the alert. What Frodo was asking was for Milton Security to poke around in a case that had already been concluded, a case in which there may have been some sort of threat to the man Blomkvist, and if they took this on, Milton would risk colliding with Wennerström's regiment of lawyers. Armansky was not in the least comforted by the thought of turning Salander loose in such a situation, like a cruise missile out of control. It was not merely a matter of concern for the company. Salander had made plain that she did not want Armansky to act as some sort of worried stepfather, and since their agreement he had been careful never to behave like one, but in reality he would never stop worrying about her. He sometimes caught himself comparing Salander to his daughters. He considered himself a good father, who did not interfere unnecessarily in their lives, but he knew that he would not tolerate it if his daughters behaved like Salander, or lived the life she led. In the depths of his Croatian, or possibly Bosnian or Armenian, heart, he had never been able to shed the conviction that Salander's life was heading for disaster. She seemed the perfect victim for anyone who wished her ill, and he dreaded the morning he would be awakened by the news that someone had done her harm.
"An investigation of this kind could get expensive," Armansky said, issuing a warning so as to gauge the seriousness of Froda's inquiry.
"Then we'll set a ceiling," Frodo said. "I don't demand the impossible, but it's obvious that your colleague, just as you assured me, is exceedingly competent."
"Salander?"
Armansky said, turning to her with a raised eyebrow. "I'm not working on anything else right now."
"Okay, but I want us to be in agreement about the constraints of the job. Let's hear the rest of your report."
"There isn't much more apart from his private life. In 1986 he married Monica Abramson, and the same year they had a daughter, Pernilla. The marriage didn't last. They were divorced in 1991. Abramson has remarried, but they seem to be friends still. The daughter lives with her mother and doesn't see Blomkvist often."
Frodo asked for more coffee and then turned to Salander. "You said that everyone has secrets. Did you find any?"
"I meant that all people have things they consider to be private and that they don't go around airing in public. Blomkvist is obviously a big hit with women. He's had several love affairs and a great many casual flings, but one person has kept turning up in his life over the years, and it's an unusual relationship."
"In what way?"
"Erika Berger, editor-in-chief of Millennium. Upper-class girl, Swedish mother, Belgian father, resident in Sweden. Berger and Blomkvist met in journalism school and have had an on-and-off relationship ever since."
"That may not be so unusual," Frodo said.
"No, possibly not, but Berger happens to be married to the artist Gregor Beckmann, a minor celebrity who has done a lot of terrible things in public venues."
"So she's unfaithful?"
"Beckmann knows about their relationship. It's a situation apparently accepted by all parties concerned. Sometimes she sleeps at Blomkvist's and sometimes at home. I don't know exactly how it works, but it was probably a contributing factor to the breakup of Blomkvist's marriage to Abramson."
Chapter 3. Friday, December 20th to Saturday, December 21st. Erika Berger looked up quizzically when an apparently freezing Blomkvist came into the editorial office. Millennium's offices were in the centre of the trendy section of Goethegarten, above the offices of Greenpeace. The rent was actually a bit too steep for the magazine, but they had all agreed to keep the space. She glanced at the clock. It was 5:10, and darkness had fallen over Stockholm long before. She had been expecting him around lunchtime.
"I'm sorry," he said before she managed to say anything, "but I was feeling the weight of the verdict and didn't feel like talking. I went for a long walk to think things over."
"I heard the verdict on the radio. She, from TV4, called and wanted a comment."
"What did you say?"
"Something to the effect that we were going to read the judgment carefully before we make any statements. So I said nothing.
and my opinion still holds. It's the wrong strategy. We come off looking weak with the media. They will run something on TV this evening.
Blomqvist looked glum.
How are you doing?
Blomqvist shrugged and plopped down in his favourite armchair next to the window in Erica's office. The decor was Spartan, with a desk and functional bookcases and cheap office furniture. All of it was from IKEA, apart from the two comfortable and extravagant armchairs and a small end table, a concession to my upbringing, she liked to say. She would sit reading in one of the armchairs with her feet tucked underneath her when she wanted to get away from the desk. Blomqvist looked down on Gurtgarten, where people were hurrying by in the dark. Christmas shopping was in full swing.
"I suppose it'll pass," he said. "But right now it feels as if I got myself a very raw deal."
"Yes, I can imagine. It's the same for all of us. Jana Dahlman went home early today."
"I assume he wasn't over the moon about the verdict?"
"He's not the most positive person anyway."
Mikhail shook his head. For the past 9 months, Dahlman had been managing editor. He had started there just as the Wennerström affair got going, and he found himself on an editorial staff in crisis mode. Blomqvist tried to remember what their reasoning had been when he and Berger decided to hire him. He was competent, of course, and had worked at the TT News Bureau, the Evening Papers, and Echo on the radio. But he apparently did not like sailing against the wind. During the past year, Blomqvist had often regretted that they had hired Dahlman, who had an enervating habit of looking at everything in as negative a light as possible.
"Have you heard from Krista?"
Blomqvist asked, without taking his eyes off the street. Krista Malm was the art director and designer of Millennium. He was also part owner of the magazine, together with Berger and Blomqvist, but he was on a trip abroad with his boyfriend.
"He called to say hello."
"He'll have to be the one who takes over as publisher."
"Lay off, Mika. As publisher, you have to count on being punched in the nose every so often. It's part of the job description."
"You're right about that. But I was the one who wrote the article that was published in a magazine of which I also happened to be the publisher. That makes everything look different all of a sudden. Then it's a matter of bad judgment."
Berger felt that the disquiet she had been carrying with her all day was about to explode. In the weeks before the trial started, Blomqvist had been walking around under a black cloud, but she had never seen him as gloomy and dejected as he seemed to be now in the hour of his defeat. She walked to his side of the desk and sat on his lap, straddling him, and put her arms round his neck.
"Mikhail, listen to me. We both know exactly how it happened. I'm as much to blame as you are. We simply have to ride out the storm."
"There isn't any storm to ride out. As far as the media are concerned, the verdict means that I've been shot in the back of the head. I can't stay on as the publisher of Millennium. The vital thing is to maintain the magazine's credibility, to stop the bleeding. You know that as well as I do."
"If you think I intend to let you take the rap all by yourself, then you haven't learned a damn thing about me in the years we've worked together."
"I know how you operate, Ricky. You're 100% loyal to your colleagues. If you had to choose, you keep fighting against Wennerström's lawyers until your credibility was gone too. We have to be smarter than that."
"And do you think it's smart to jump ship and make it look as if I sacked you?"
"If Millennium is going to survive, it depends on you now. Krista is great, but he's just a nice guy who knows about images and layout and doesn't have a clue about street fighting with billionaires. It's just not his thing. I'm going to have to disappear for a while, as publisher, reporter, and board member. Wennerström knows that I know what he did, and I'm absolutely sure that as long as I'm anywhere near Millennium, he's going to try to ruin us."
"So why not publish everything we know? Sink or swim?"
"Because we can't prove a damn thing, and right now I have no credibility at all. Let's accept that Wennerström won this round."
"Okay, I'll fire you. What are you going to do?"
"I need a break, to be honest. I'm burned right out. I'm going to take some time for myself for a while, some of it in prison, then we'll see."
Berger put her arms around him and pulled his head down to her breasts. She hugged him hard.
"Want some company tonight?"
she said.
Blomqvist nodded.
"Good. I've already told Gregor I'm at your place tonight."
The streetlights reflecting off the corners of the windows were all that lit the room. When Berger fell asleep sometime after 2 in the morning, Blomqvist lay awake, studying her profile in the dimness. The covers were down around her waist, and he watched her breasts slowly rising and falling. He was relaxed, and the anxious knot in his stomach had eased. She had that effect on him. She always had had. And he knew that he had the same effect on her. 20 years, he thought. That's how long it had been. As far as he was concerned, they could go on sleeping together for another 2 decades. At least. They had never seriously tried to hide their relationship, even when it led to awkwardness in their dealings with other people. They had met at a party when they were both in their 2nd year at journalism school. Before they said good night, they had exchanged telephone numbers. They both knew that they would end up in bed together, and in less than a week they realized this conviction without telling their respective partners. Blomqvist was sure that it was not the old-fashioned kind of love that leads to a shared home, a shared mortgage, Christmas trees and children. During the 80s, when they were not bound by other relationships, they had talked of moving in together. He had wanted to, but Erica always backed out at the last minute. It wouldn't work, she said. They would risk what they had if they fell in love, too. Blomqvist had often wondered whether it were possible to be more possessed by desire for any other woman. The fact was that they functioned well together, and they had a connection as addictive as heroin. Sometimes they were together so often that it felt as though they really were a couple. Sometimes weeks and months would go by before they saw each other. But even as alcoholics are drawn to the state liquor store after a stint on the wagon, they always came back to each other. Inevitably, it did not work in the long run. That kind of relationship was almost bound to cause pain. They had both left broken promises and unhappy lovers behind. His own marriage had collapsed because he could not stay away from Erica Berger. He had never lied about his feelings for her to his wife Monica, but she had thought it would end when they married and their daughter was born, and Berger had almost simultaneously married Gregor Beckmann. Blomqvist, too, had thought it would end, and for the first years of his marriage he and Berger had only seen each other professionally. Then they started Millennium, and within a few weeks all their good intentions had dissolved, and one late evening they had furious sex on her desk. That led to a troublesome period in which Blomqvist wanted very much to live with his family and see his daughter grow up, but at the same time he was helplessly drawn to Berger. Just as Salander had guessed, it was his continual infidelity that drove his wife to leave. Strangely enough, Beckmann seemed to accept their relationship. Berger had always been open about her feelings for Mikael, and she told her husband as soon as they started having sex again. Maybe it took the soul of an artist to handle such a situation, someone so wrapped up in his own creativity, or possibly just wrapped up in himself, that he did not rebel when his wife slept with another man. She even divided up her holidays so she could spend 2 weeks with her lover in his summer cabin at Sandhamn. Blomqvist did not think very highly of Beckmann, and he had never understood Berger's love for him, but he was glad that he accepted that she could love 2 men at the same time. Blomqvist could not sleep, and at 4 he gave up. He went to the kitchen and read the court judgment one more time from beginning to end. Having the document in his hand, he had a sense that there had been something almost fateful about the meeting at Arholma. He could never be sure whether Lindberg had told him the details of Wennerström's swindle simply for the sake of a good story between toasts in the privacy of his boat's cabin, or whether he had really wanted the story to be made public. He tended to believe the first, but it may have been that Lindberg, for his own personal or business reasons, had wanted to damage Wennerström, and he had seized the opportunity of having a captive journalist on board. Lindberg had been sober enough to insist on Blomqvist treating him as an anonymous source. From that moment, Lindberg could say what he liked, because his friend would never be able to disclose his source. If the meeting at Arholma had been a set-up, then Lindberg could not have played his role better. But the meeting had to have happened by chance. Lindberg could have had no notion of the extent of Blomqvist's contempt for people like Wennerström. For all that, after years of study, he was privately convinced that there was not a single bank director or celebrity corporate executive who wasn't also a cretin. Blomqvist had never heard of Lisbeth Salander, and was happily innocent of her report delivered earlier that day, but had he listened to it, he would have nodded in agreement when she spoke of his loathing for bean counters,
saying that it was not a manifestation of his left-wing political radicalism. Mikhail was not uninterested in politics, but he was extremely sceptical of political isms. He had voted only once in a parliamentary election in 1982, and then he had hesitantly plumped for the Social Democrats, there being nothing in his imagination worse than 3 years more with Gösta Bormann as finance minister and Thorbjörn Fälldin, or possibly Ola Ullsten, as prime minister. So he had voted for Olof Palme, and got instead the assassination of his prime minister, plus the Bofors scandal and Ebbe Carlsson. His contempt for his fellow financial journalists was based on something that, in his opinion, was as plain as morality. The equation was simple. A bank director who blows millions on foolhardy speculations should not keep his job. A managing director who plays shell company games should do time. A slum landlord who forces young people to pay through the nose and under the table for a one-room apartment with shared toilet should be hung out to dry. The job of the financial journalist was to examine the sharks who created interest crises and speculated away the savings of small investors, to scrutinize company boards with the same merciless zeal with which political reporters pursue the tiniest steps out of line of ministers and members of parliament. He could not, for the life of him, understand why so many influential financial reporters treated mediocre financial whelps like rock stars. These recalcitrant views had, time after time, brought him into conflict with his peers. Borg, for one, was going to be an enemy for life. His taking on a role of social critic had actually transformed him into a prickly guest on TV sofas. He was always the one invited to comment whenever any CEO was caught with a golden parachute worth billions. Mikhail had no trouble imagining that champagne bottles had been uncorked in some newspaper's back rooms that evening. Erika had the same attitude to the journalist's role as he did. Even when they were in journalism school, they had amused themselves by imagining a magazine with just such a mission statement. Erika was the best boss Mikhail could imagine. She was an organizer who could handle employees with warmth and trust, but who at the same time wasn't afraid of confrontation, and could be very tough when necessary. Above all, she had an icy, gut feeling when it came to making decisions about the contents of the upcoming issue. She and Mikhail often had differing views and could have healthy arguments, but they also had unwavering confidence in each other, and together they made an unbeatable team. He did the fieldwork of tracking down the story while she packaged and marketed it. Millennium was their mutual creation, but it would never have become reality without her talent for digging up financing. It was the working-class guy and the upper-class girl in a beautiful union. Erika came from old money. She had put up the initial seed money and then talked both her father and various acquaintances into investing considerable sums in the project. Mikhail had often wondered why Erika had set her sights on Millennium. True, she was a part owner, the majority partner, in fact, and editor-in-chief of her own magazine, which gave her prestige and the control over publicity that she could hardly have obtained in any other job. Unlike Mikhail, she had concentrated on television after journalism school. She was tough, looked fantastic on camera, and could hold her own with the competition. She also had good contacts in the bureaucracy. If she had stuck to it, she would undoubtedly have had a managerial job at one of the TV channels at a considerably higher salary than she paid herself now. Berger had also convinced Christer Malm to buy into the magazine. He was an exhibitionist gay celebrity who sometimes appeared with his boyfriend in At Home With articles. The interest in him began when he moved in with Arnold Magnusson, an actor with a background at the Royal Dramatic Theatre, who had made a serious breakthrough when he played himself in a docu-soap. Krista and Arn had then become a media item. At 36, Malm was a sought-after professional photographer and designer who gave Millennium a modern look. He ran his business from an office on the same floor as Millennium, and he did graphic design 1 week in every month. The Millennium staff consisted of 3 full-time employees, a full-time trainee and 2 part-timers. It was not a lucrative affair, but the magazine broke even, and the circulation and advertising revenue had increased gradually but steadily. Until today, the magazine was known for its frank and reliable editorial style. Now the situation would in all probability be changing.
Blomqvist read through the press release which he and Berger had drafted, and which had quickly been converted to a wire service story from TT that was already up on Aftonbladet's website. Convicted reporter leaves Millennium. Stockholm, TT. Journalist Mikael Blomqvist is leaving his post as publisher of the magazine Millennium, reports editor-in-chief and majority shareholder Erika Berger. Blomqvist is leaving Millennium of his own choice. He's exhausted after the drama of recent months and needs time off, says Berger, who will take over the role of publisher. Blomqvist was one of the founders of Millennium, started in 1990. Berger does not think that the magazine will suffer in the wake of the so-called Wennerström affair. The magazine will come out as usual next month, says Berger. Mikael Blomqvist has played a major role in the magazine's development, but now we're turning a new page. Berger states that she regards the Wennerström affair as the result of a series of unfortunate circumstances. She regrets the nuisance to which Hans-Erik Wennerström was subjected. Blomqvist could not be reached for comment.
It makes me mad, Berger said when the press release was emailed out. Most people are going to think that you're an idiot, and I'm a bitch who's taking the opportunity to sack you.
At least our friends will have something new to laugh about. Blomqvist tried to make light of it. She was not the least amused.
I don't have a plan B, but I think we're making a mistake, she said.
It's the only way out. If the magazine collapses, all our years of work will have been in vain. We've already taken a beating on the ads revenue. How did it go with the computer company, by the way?
She sighed. They told me this morning that they didn't want to take space in the next issue.
Wennerström has a chunk of stock in that company, so it's no accident.
We can scare up some new clients. Wennerström may be a big wheel, but he doesn't own everything in Sweden, and we have our contacts.
Blomqvist put an arm around her and pulled her close.
Some day, we're going to nail Herr Wennerström so hard Wall Street is going to jump out of its socks. But today, Millennium has to get out of the spotlight.
I know all that, but I don't like coming across as a fucking bitch, and you're being forced into a disgusting situation if we pretend that there's some sort of division between you and me.
Ricky, as long as you and I trust each other, we've got a chance. We have to play it by ear, and right now it's time to retreat.
She reluctantly admitted that there was a depressing logic to what he said. Chapter 4. Monday, December 23rd to Thursday, December 26th. Berger stayed over the weekend. They got up only to go to the bathroom or to get something to eat. But they had not only made love. They had lain head to foot for hours and talked about the future, weighing up the possibilities and the odds. When dawn came on Monday morning, it was the day before Christmas Eve, and she kissed him goodbye, until next time, and drove home. Blomqvist spent Monday washing dishes and cleaning the apartment, then walking down to the office and clearing out his desk. He had no intention of breaking ties with the magazine, but he had eventually convinced Berger that he had to be separated from the magazine for a time. He would work from home. The office was closed for the Christmas holidays, and all his colleagues were gone. He was weeding through trays of papers and packing books in cartons to take away when the telephone rang.
"I'm looking for Mikael Blomqvist," said a hopeful but unfamiliar voice on the line.
"Speaking?"
"Forgive me for bothering you like this, unannounced, so to speak. My name is Dirk Frode."
Blomqvist noted the name and the time.
"I'm a lawyer, and I represent a client who would very much like to have a talk with you."
"That's fine. Please ask your client to call me."
"I mean that he wants to meet with you in person."
"Okay, make an appointment and send him up to the office. But you better hurry, I'm clearing out my desk right now."
"My client would like you to meet him in Hedestad. It's only 3 hours by train."
Blomqvist pushed a filing tray aside. The media have the ability to attract the craziest people to call in perfectly absurd tips. Every newsroom in the world gets updates from ufologists, graphologists, Scientologists, paranoiacs, every sort of conspiracy theorist. Blomqvist had once listened to a lecture by the writer Carl Alvar Nielsen at the ABF Hall on the anniversary of the murder of Prime Minister Olof Palme. The lecture was serious, and in the audience were Lennart Bodström and other friends of Palme's.
but a surprising number of amateur investigators had turned up. One of them was a woman in her 40s, who, during the Q&A, had taken the proffered microphone and then lowered her voice to a barely audible whisper. This alone heralded an interesting development, and nobody was surprised when the woman began by claiming, "I know who murdered Olof Palme." From the stage it was suggested, somewhat ironically, that if the woman had this information, then it would be helpful if she shared it with the Palme investigation at once. She hurried to reply, "I can't." She said so softly it was almost impossible to hear. "It's too dangerous." Blomqvist wondered whether this Frodo was another one of the truth-sayers who could reveal the secret mental hospital where Seppo, the security police, ran experiments on thought control.
"I don't make house calls," he said.
"I hope I can convince you to make an exception. My client is over 80, and for him it would be too exhausting to come down to Stockholm. If you insist, we could certainly arrange something, but to tell you the truth, it would be preferable if you would be so kind."
"Who is your client?"
"A person whose name I suspect you have heard in your work. Henrik Wanger."
Blomqvist leaned back in surprise. Henrik Wanger? Of course he had heard of him. An industrialist and former head of the Wanger companies, once renowned in the fields of sawmills, mines, steels, metals, textiles. Wanger had been one of the really big fish in his day, with a reputation for being an honourable, old-fashioned patriarch who would not bend in a strong wind. A cornerstone of Swedish industry, one of the 20-point stags of the old school, along with Mats Carlgren of Modo and Hans Werten at the old Electrolux. The backbone of industry in the welfare state, etc. But the Wanger companies, still family-owned, had been racked in the past 25 years by reorganizations, stock market crises, interest crises, competition from Asia, declining exports, and other nuisances which taken together had consigned the name Wanger to the backwater. The company was run today by Martin Wanger, whose name Blomqvist associated with a short, plump man with thick hair who occasionally flickered past on the TV screen. He did not know much about him. Henrik Wanger had been out of the picture for at least 20 years.
"Why does Henrik Wanger want to meet me?"
"I've been Herr Wanger's lawyer for many years, but he will have to tell you himself what he wants. On the other hand, I can say that Herr Wanger would like to discuss a possible job with you."
"Job?
I don't have the slightest intention of going to work for the Wanger company. Is it a press secretary you need?" "Not exactly. I don't know how to put it other than to say that Herr Wanger is exceedingly anxious to meet you and consult with you on a private matter."
"You couldn't get more equivocal, could you?"
"I beg your pardon for that. But is there any possibility of convincing you to pay a visit to Hedestad? Naturally, we will pay all your expenses and a reasonable fee."
"Your call comes at rather an inconvenient time. I have quite a lot to take care of, and I suppose you've seen the headlines about me in the past few days?"
"The Wennerström affair?" Frodo chuckled. "Yes, that did have a certain amusement value. But to tell you the truth, it was the publicity surrounding the trial that caused Herr Wanger to take notice of you. He wants to offer you a freelance assignment. I'm only a messenger. What the matter concerns is something only he can explain."
"This is one of the odder calls I've had in a long time. Let me think about it. How can I reach you?"
Blomqvist sat looking at the disorder on his desk. He could not imagine what sort of job Wanger would want to offer him, but the lawyer had succeeded in arousing his curiosity. He googled the Wanger company. It might be in the backwaters, but it seemed to be in the media almost daily. He saved a dozen company analyses and then searched for Frode and Henrik and Martin Wanger. Martin Wanger appeared diligent in his capacity as CEO of the Wanger Corporation. Frode kept a low profile. He was on the board of the Hedestad Country Club and active in the Rotary Club. Henrik Wanger appeared with one exception, only in articles giving the background of the company. The Hedestad Courier had published a tribute to the former magnate on his 80th birthday 2 years ago, and it included a short sketch. He put together a folder of 50 pages or so, Then, finally, he emptied his desk, sealed the cartons, and, having no idea whether he would come back, went home. Salander spent Christmas Eve at the Eppelviken nursing home in Upplands Väsby. She had brought presents, a bottle of Eau de Toilette de Dior and an English fruit cake from Öhlins department store. She drank coffee as she watched the 46-year-old woman who, with